shape to think about liberating education. That's what the overall title of this session is. My name is Jody Kretzman, and I'm up here for the summer doing the program coordinator's job with my spouse Ingrid. And in the rest of our lives, we work in Chicago in an urban studies program for a group of Midwest colleges, and that's partly what I'm going to talk about. This is Joel Muggy. He's the director of the Center for Global Education at in Minneapolis, connected with Augsburg College, and he, of course, is responsible for leading groups of inquiring minds all over the globe for some kind of expansion of those minds. Joel and I have known each other for a long time, and we have, as our paths have crossed over the years, we've had bits and pieces of what we always say needs to be a much longer conversation. Because it seems to us, when we talk about what I do in Chicago and what Joel does with his groups globally, that there is an awful lot of similarity, that the patterns of pedagogy are remarkably similar, that what happens to people when they visit Central America for 3 weeks is a lot like what happens to people when they really get into a place like Chicago for a semester with us. So what we thought we would do at least is to take a little bit of advantage of the fact that we've had some delightful conversations up here at Holden and do a little bit of ad hoc dialoguing in front of you about what it is that we have learned about education, or at least think we've learned, and lay a little bit of that on the table and then ask all of you to help us think about what we've learned. We thought we'd do that in a couple of stages, that it might be helpful for a couple of minutes at the beginning for each of us to describe briefly what it is we do so that you have some kind of a concrete basis for at least entering into what's affected our thinking about education. And then we might each briefly take on very briefly three more questions. One, out of our educational experience, what kinds of critiques of the major institutions that sponsor us, in my case universities, in Joel's case the church, what kinds of critiques have arisen for us? Secondly, a little bit of at least beginning thinking about what our experience in the education game has meant for thinking about how policy gets formed in our particular bailiwicks, that is my own work in urban policy domestically and Joel's work in foreign policy. And finally, just a story or two probably about what we think happens to people who have been engaged in these endeavors with us over the years. That shouldn't take too long, and it should leave us some time, we hope, for some interchange about what it is that liberating education might be about. Okay, first then let me just give you 2 minutes about my own scene. I direct an urban studies program in Chicago that's now almost 20 years old. It started in 1969. It looked to me at that point, I was one of the founders of it, it looked to me like a good 3-month way to pay the bills while I was doing community organizing and anti-war organizing and trying to do a number of things that paid no money at all. A colleague and I were meeting with a series of committees put together by Midwestern colleges. The Associated Colleges of the Midwest is a group of small liberal arts colleges. Most of you know St. Olaf. It also includes McAllister and Carleton and Lawrence and Grinnell. 13 of those kinds of schools. And in 1969, they were thinking about the fact that they were all located in cornfields, basically, with the exception of McAllister and St. Paul. And that all of their students, in 1969 anyway, were fascinated by cities, not by cornfields. And further, they were bright enough to realize that whether or not their students were fascinated by cities, they would mostly end up there. And that it was part of the educational enterprise to get them acquainted with urban America, to get them somehow to be feeling at home with what it was to be in a city. So they were interested in an urban studies program. We basically argued 2 points with them at the founding of our program, and those two points have been crucial throughout our 20 years. We argued, first, if you're going to take a city seriously, you can't rotate faculty into the city from Northfield, Minnesota, or Grinnell, Iowa, and expect those faculty to be engaged in the way that they need to be in order to teach students. In other words, you need to hire Associated Colleges, a permanent faculty in Chicago, if you want to do this seriously. They finally said fine to that. The other thing we said to them is that if you're going to do this seriously, we think it needs to be experience-based. We think that we shouldn't be doing anything in Chicago with your students that you can do in the Carleton Library or in the Grinnell Library. You should do everything you need to do with your students in the Grinnell Library and let us do everything we can possibly do with them to experience the city, to get them into the city, to get them encountered with the people of the city. So that's essentially what we do. We get about anywhere from 60 to 100 students for a four-month period. They come with us. We've got a little staff of a faculty of 12 people, diverse in terms of the networks that our major criterion for hiring faculty is not necessarily their publication records, although there are some good ones there too, but what sort of networks of contacts and connections and experiences they bring to the teaching scene in addition to being good teachers themselves. So we are able to get away with not hiring all PhDs, although we've got a number of them, which is very helpful. Our job as 12 folks who are plugged into the city is simply to sort of take the 60 to 100 students by the hand and be with them for 4 months as we do the city together. We ask them to read a lot less than they do on the Carleton and St. Olaf campuses. We have them every morning in our versions of classes, which are mostly extended conversations with major actors in the city. So when I do city politics, mostly my class and I are down at City Hall or out in the neighborhood in an alderman's office. And then we're thinking together and talking together about what it is we just heard. The city emerges for our students, I think, as a very human place, a very flesh and blood place, but a place of incredible complexity and diversity. Easy truths disappear very quickly. The contradictions of perspectives on the same topic, which bombard the students day after day after day, are the kind that shake anybody up, and shake particularly 20 and 21 year olds. These are mostly juniors and seniors, smart, half social science students, half humanities, arts, pre-med, the rest of the stuff. In the afternoons, after we have them in class every morning, they all do internships for 15 or 20 hours a week. So we'll have all 90 or 100 out working in everything from the mayor's office to community organizations to Cook County Hospital to the symphony to the mural group in the Mexican community to a variety of halfway houses to the Lyric Opera. A whole range of possibilities for them to choose, and again, that becomes an occasion for them to try out some possible futures, and then to bring their experience back into a group to reflect about those about that work experience with a group of people who are not in the same work experience. So they're living in neighborhoods, they're interning in a variety of urban institutions, and they're with us doing a variety of sort of academically organized experiences in the mornings. I'll talk a little bit at the end about some of the stuff that I think happens to students, but suffice it to say that one of the things that happens early in each semester is the creation of a kind of community of co-learners. That is, they know, the students know very quickly that none of the dozen of us can possibly know everything there is to know about this city. They see us honestly groping to try to understand what's going on in this town in a variety of different categories. That shifts the whole kind of learning context. It shifts it to it breaks down that kind of faculty-student set of barriers in a way that allows us to really inquire into the nature of these sort of shifting realities as co-explorers. And that's an exciting kind of experience, which for many of our students is a kind of passage into an adulthood, which allows them to be sort of critical examiners of reality themselves. and that's an exciting thing to see happen. So that's sort of what we do, and we do that twice a year for two semesters. And it is marvelous and exciting, but very exhausting work, and it's fun to come to Holden and rest for a little while.
Joel. Well, the Center for Global Education, which I direct in Minneapolis, also has an academic component to it, which I'll tell you about in a minute, and has then kind of also expanded in some areas beyond that. The center is only 6 years old. I had no idea you were 20 years old, my goodness. Yeah. Can't believe doing something for 20 years.
I had no idea, actually.
Basically, the center evolved in 1982 as a kind of an umbrella to incorporate many things that had been happening that I've been involved in for a number of years at Augsburg. The most recent of which had been the development of an undergraduate semester program in Cuernavaca, Mexico in 1979. I've been doing educational groups of one kind or another in Latin America since about 1970. But in 79 we began a semester program which was called the Program in Global Community, and that continues to this day. It's a part of what we do. And that then evolved, and in about 1982, that with many of the other requests we were getting, led to the formation of the Center for Global Education. Let me begin, there's several facets of what we do, and let me begin with that undergraduate semester program. The program in Global Community is based in Cuernavaca, Mexico, and it's open to students from any college or university. Much smaller scale in terms of numbers than the program Jody's talking about, a maximum of 20 students, in which we use an interdisciplinary approach to explore the history of political change, the dynamics of social justice in Latin America, and the role of the church in Latin America. And then, of course, to use that experience, as a result of that experience, to reflect back on our own society and on the church in this country. The objectives of the program are to help students become aware of the issues involved in the struggle to build a just society, to put it in its broadest concepts, and to help them learn about and experience the meaning of community in both a personal context and in a global context. And finally, I think, to encourage them to reflect upon the role and responsibility of people of faith in working for social and political change, especially, again, in an international arena. They receive credit for a number of courses, but much like the courses Jody described, they're very experiential in nature. They include field trips to rural villages, a dialogue with a wide variety of resource people within the Cuernavaca and Mexico City area. As a part of that program, they live for a portion of their experience in a study center we have in Cuernavaca. They spend a portion of their time living with base Christian community families in Cuernavaca. And some of you were in my session on base Christian communities, so you know what that's about. And these are poor families, generally. One would say lower middle class on down in terms of the social strata. So they're pretty basic in terms of the amenities, and that's always a very powerful experience for students. And then there's also a period of time in a kind of work experience in a rural village where the students live together but are in interaction with the villagers. And finally, there's usually a two-week component in which the students travel to Central America from Mexico. That program, and again, using many of the same kinds of models that Jody described, the idea of co-learners. There is a faculty person. There's also our permanent staff in Cuernavaca that participate in this program, but in very much a co-learning in style, in which we help people to make the connections rather than feed them the information. We in fact just added a second semester program that will begin this fall in cooperation with PLU, and that program is called Human Services in a Latin American Context, and with much the same dynamic, its focus, rather than being on theology particularly will be on education and social work, those kinds of students primarily. And this program, we're also adding what we have not had before, is a field study or internship experience as a part of the program. So this, particularly the program in Global Community, was sort of the foundation of our program and existed prior to the Center for Global Education itself. About the third year that I was directing the program in Cuernavaca, we began to get requests from church groups to have a shorter term experience in Mexico of a similar nature. And so what began to evolve and then became incorporated into the work of the Center for Global Education is what now has become our program of travel seminars to Latin America and other parts of the world. These seminars are designed primarily for adult learners and are usually anywhere from 10 days to 3 weeks in length. People meet with a wide range of representatives of government, of business, church, grassroots communities, and visit various relief and development organizations, embassies, and leaders of government. We really coordinate two types of travel seminars. The one type we call global education seminars, which are designed, I guess one would say, more for church-oriented groups. They're designed to introduce participants to the realities of poverty and injustice in the regions where we travel, to look particularly at the root causes of those conditions, and the role of U.S. foreign policy. And again, as in the semester program, to encourage people to reflect on the role and responsibility of people of faith in addressing these problems. We also have, in the last two or three years, begun to do an increasing number of what we call foreign policy seminars, in which the groups are generally non-church based, and they tend to focus more on the nature of regional conflicts and the impact of U.S. policy on those conflicts. They tend to be designed more for civic leaders and elected officials on the state and national level. I should mention that our work has, while it has been concentrated in Central America and Mexico, we've also begun to do work now in the Philippines, in several islands in the Caribbean, and in the Middle East as well. And finally, I'd say a third dimension of our program, we do a number of things locally in Minneapolis, but I'm going to try to focus on the major things, is really an aspect of our program that's evolved to serve the other two. And that has been the development of guest houses and permanent staffs in two countries in Central America and permanent staff in a couple of other countries. In Cuernavaca and Managua, we have guest centers or guest houses that hold about 20 people. And we have a permanent staff, including support staff, cooks, bus drivers, vehicles, all of that sort of thing. Which designs and implements the programs in that particular country. And this spring we also added a staff person in Guatemala and another staff person in El Salvador. The staff, I think the way that staff functions is also very important. We really have begun that for a couple of reasons. The primary reason is so that what's so critical to our program is the development of levels of trust between our program and the people in these communities who we ask to be resources and teachers for our programs. That kind of trust is essential if we're going to hope to ask, in many cases, ask people to take risks with us and to share their own reality in a way that could be risky to them in their particular situation. And so that development of trust is very important. And so because of that, our staff also becomes as involved as much as possible in the life of the community in which they're situated. We also try to involve members of the community in shaping the in-country program in each of those areas. So each of our centers has a program advisory council in that location that is made up of people who live there that help. We have some ideas what our people should learn when they go there, but they have ideas about what our people should learn that may be more important than our ideas. And so we've had our staff people, for example, have been involved in teaching literacy training in Nicaragua. They've been involved, we had one staff member who was a member of the Nicaraguan National Symphony We've had staff members who have taught base Christian communities, or not taught, but been participating in them. So that participation in the life of the community is a very important aspect of our staff in the region. I think that gives you a bit of an overview of the content of both of our programs. I'd like to just share what I think are, having heard what we've talked about, what I think are some assumptions about education that both of us operate with in our work. First, I think we believe that the best kind of learning is learning how to learn. That the most important thing to be learned is how to open ourselves up to a process of change. How to be continually willing to change. I mean, that's a pretty big step for us to take. I don't think our schools tend to condition us to do that. And to be open to a process of change both within ourselves and in the world. That openness to change, I always say, is one of the first kind of concrete actions that people can take, is to put yourself in a situation where you continue to learn. Secondly, I think we believe that the most effective learning takes place in the context of our experience. When we engage in concrete actions and activity in the world, and then reflect on the results and meaning of that action. And you see that in the style of both of the programs we're describing here. That involvement with what's happening in the world, what's very important is not just that involvement, but the reflection on that involvement and beginning to integrate that into our own experience. Third, I think we believe that learning happens best in the context of community in some way or another, as opposed to sort of an individual endeavor. That this idea that Jody talked about of co-learners, that we all are teachers and learners together, is a very important aspect of our experience. When I lead a travel seminar, for example, or when I was directing the semester program, each of those experiences was as much a learning experience for me as it was for those students. Fourth, we believe that real education is education that enables and allows us to think critically about our world and our role in it, rather than simply to assume our proper role in the world, or to assume our niche in society, the niche that society wants us to fill. Rather that what real education, I think, is education that enables us to think very critically about what the world is about and what our role and participation in the world is about. And I think finally we understand our role as educators in this process to be one of not providing the answers for people, but creating the occasion for dialogue. Helping people make connections and ask questions. Helping others connect with those who can provide the answers, perhaps, to their questions, or who can raise more questions for them. And allowing those who share their lives with our students, whatever shape those students are, be the interpreters of their own experience. I've seen very bad examples of the work we do, especially in Latin America, and where I've heard North Americans have to comment on everything that some Latin America says about their experience and help us North Americans understand it. But rather that we let the people be the authorities of their own experience, and it's from them we learn. And our task is to help our fellow learners make connections with the experience of others.
So, those five assumptions, it seems to me, easily leads one into what really could be a two-week lecture here, but it's going to be 2 minutes instead, which is a critique of higher education in the United States. It seems to me all of those five assumptions are absolutely out in the street, given where higher education is in the United States. One easy way that I think about my own sort of friendly dialogue of criticism with my colleagues in higher education and on these campuses and on the universities. The research universities, I think, are actually worse than these liberal arts campuses are in terms of non-liberating education. One way to think about the problem with these campuses is that there are immense and thick walls between lots of elements of the educational environment where there should not be any walls, or at least where the walls should be permeable and see-through in a variety of ways. Education is non-liberating in most universities and colleges because it is encapsulated, the organization of learning is encapsulated into disciplines. If there's one thing that has happened over the last 30 years, it is that disciplines have become not, it seems to me, any longer, for most people, sort of windows out into the rest of reality, out into the rest of the exploration of the world, but they have been rather sort of encapsulated, increasingly iron, corrugated boxes that you have to work your way through and into, and once you're in them, you never get out. It's certainly true of my, you know, my first all but dissertation PhD was in American literature, and I could barely talk to my colleagues anymore in that discipline because they're all using computers and counting words and into very abstruse discussions about deconstructionism, which it seems to me is very difficult to figure out where the links are anymore between real life and that. My second set of graduate experiences that I finally finished, but with my nose held, were in the social sciences, and those people too were very interested in counting things. And knowledge, it seems to me, within the research university's ambience at least, has become increasingly limited to that which you can count, and that which you can count within a particular discipline. The language barriers between disciplines have gotten worse. The kind of priestly codification of each of the languages has gotten worse. It seems to me that when you do that to a discipline, your ability to ask holistic questions, and in fact your ability to do most kinds of creative thinking, is really sort of atrophies. Lots of the most creative thinking, it seems to me, goes on at the edges of disciplines, goes on where disciplines intersect with each other, where the social sciences and the arts intersect, or where theology and the social sciences intersect, or where the hard sciences and the arts intersect. That's where the creativity is, and it's harder and harder for people, particularly young people, to get anywhere near the edges of those disciplines because they're locked into the boxes. Well, a liberating education would knock down a lot of those walls, and luckily there is no way you can divide a living city into those disciplinary categories. They just don't apply. The minute you think you're doing political science, you're obviously doing economics and even religion at the same time. The city helps us in that way, it seems to me, to open ourselves up. The walls between community and university, it seems to me, have grown higher and more impenetrable over the last 30 years. We're not talking here just about town and gown and the usual kinds of tensions between campuses and communities, but really about the gap between the experience of people living real lives and the experience of people living academic lives. That kind of gap seems to me to have widened and needs to be torn down as well. University of Chicago, in my view, a marvelous old-style center of learning in the city of Chicago, might as well be located in Grinnell, Iowa, for all that it has to do with the city of Chicago. It's in a place where the walls have been erected, and it has very, very little to do with the reality of the 8 million people that make up the community around it. Occasionally it sort of studies them through long distance binoculars, but that's it. Increasingly, it seems to me, in higher education, the break from Joel's assumptions between thought and activity, the break between doing something and thinking about it, between reflection and action, that gap has gone wider and wider and wider. It is more and more difficult to engage academics in reflection about what it is that is meaningful activity in our society. And the gap between a variety, finally, of the actors within the university setting, it seems to me, also to be getting wider and wider. Whether you're talking about sort of broadening stratification of academic institutions themselves, that is from community colleges to the Harvards and the University of Chicago, whether you're talking about the status of student versus the status of faculty, whether you're talking about the status of different kinds of faculty, whether you're talking about staff versus faculty, that the kind of walls between people within the academic enterprise itself have also become higher and more impenetrable. All of these, it seems to me, are non-liberating trends. They are trends that tend to stultify thought, that tend to catch people in their habits. They are sort of anti, it seems to me, the very spirit of what the liberating arts had in mind, even in the classical sense. So I have some trouble with higher education from my vantage point.
And I have some trouble with the church from my vantage point in terms of education. I think the question of what would liberating education mean for the church, if it can really take place in the church, is the way I'd like to kind of focus this. Because I think part of, I really identify with everything Jody said, because one aspect of our program has been an academic program that functions in a very similar way. And one of the things that we see too, in the light of that, is the extent to which students are trapped into that old system, even though they have consciously taken made a decision to step into something new. When you get into areas of grades and all that sort of thing, they find themselves really struggling with how liberating do I want my education to be, really, because it really ultimately means that I have to take full responsibility for my education. I think with respect to the church, a true liberating education within the context of the church would have to mean a number of things in terms of the way the church begins to look at its mission. First of all, it really suggests seriously the concept of the priesthood of all believers. It makes a critique, I think, of what in many cases is the traditional role of the pastor, and because it suggests really that all members of the community have equal responsibility for mission and ministry. The pastor is not the sole source of truth, nor the sole dispenser of the means of grace, but one who facilitates theological reflection and action of the community. And that's a much different kind of way of thinking about it than is really the case in most of our parishes, I think. Also, I think, again, is the centrality of this concept of community, which is talked about a lot in our churches, but is so often lacking. That the idea that a faith experience is not individual, but happens in community. The kind of base Christian communities are one example of how that sort of living community can be both really the source of the kind of education that we're talking about here, as well as a product of it. I think a liberating education for the church implies the church must be deeply involved in the life of the world, engaged in problems and issues that confront the world. And too often, I think, we find the church not engaged in those kinds of questions in the way we'd like to see them. A further continuation of that suggests that the church can never remain neutral in the political arena. If one is truly involved in a liberating approach to education, there's no such thing as neutrality, because neutrality is not neutrality at all, but acceptance of the status quo. And that's not very neutral in most cases. The church that would emanate out of this view of education and ministry would be one that's speaking out for justice and peace and for institutional structures that are just. I think perhaps the area where a liberation view of education would have and has had the most impact on the church is in its view of mission, particularly foreign mission. There are many today who are talking about internationalization of mission and reverse mission, those kinds of terms, in which we can no longer define our task as a church as bringing the gospel to people of the third world, but rather that when we go to the third world, we learn more clearly what the gospel means for us and the nature of mission to our own people. Again, you see that that co-learner, co-participants in mission, that concept that emerges here. The people of the third world, for example, become our teachers, those who minister to us, rather than we, the experts, those with our sort of little market on the gospel, sharing that with them. And I think it's a new view that suggests that it's also the poor and those who have experienced oppression in our own country who are also our teachers. I think that's another very important dynamic, and that it's often from those who have suffered the most that we learn what it means to be the body of Christ. I think it also implies a new set of actions for the church, if we're really to take seriously this notion. I think one is a continued commitment to learning from the oppressed. A continued commitment on the part of the church to hear another side of the story, always. But that is a part of our mission and ministry, our openness to listening to the voices of those who are speaking to us from all edges and inside and outside our society. Secondly, I think it means we begin to be involved in really solidarity with all those struggling for justice. And that can mean a variety of things, and I think all of you can think of ways in which that can happen. That kind of thinking is for many of our churches and for the church at large often very alien. It means, I think, that the church continues to be involved in acts of charity, works of charity, but that has often been the extent of the church's involvement with the poor in the past. I think those kinds of activities need to continue, but with a new awareness that they don't change anything. that doesn't change the realities that underlie the problems we're trying to meet. That maybe providing aid so some people can survive, but with a clear recognition that the kind of long-term change doesn't happen through that. And finally, I think this new kind of thinking about education in the church means that we begin to take a new stance over and against the powers and principalities, as Dan Erlander we're talking about next week. We begin to, as a church, if we're really examining the problems that underlie society in a critical way, we begin to question all kinds of things, like military spending and our government's foreign policy. All kinds of issues then become part of the reality that we're dealing with as members of the body of Christ. And finally, I think this kind of approach challenges with a vision of a truly inclusive, multicultural church, which again, for most of us, I think is a long way from the reality. A church in which the gifts of men and women and people of all colors, ages, and sexual orientations are freely given and received. Again, where we have that kind of interchange among us that allows that kind of spirit to be alive in the church.
Well, I think that would be exciting. And it's fun to watch Joel's people come back and try to put that into some kind of action, really, in their relationship with the church. Something like that happens when our students try to engage the city on a policy level. I think they've learned some things, and what some of the things that they've learned and continue to learn long after they leave us, and it doesn't have anything to do with us, but they're sort of set on a road, makes them think about what to do about cities differently, how to set policy differently. Three brief things, I think, that they have learned that's a little different. Some semesters, we start them off, their first day, they're green, right from Northfield, Minnesota. We start them off at the top of the Sears Tower, which is, of course, the largest, tallest building in the world, and sort of take them to the top of the mountain there and have them look out over the city, and usually the planning commissioner of the city of Chicago, with one of the heads of one of the major downtown business groups, talks to them for a couple of hours about what it is they're seeing outside the Sears Tower. Talks about land use and development questions and major questions like how do you redo the lakefront and questions of overall tax base and industrial job retention and the big macro kind of policy questions. We do that for a couple of hours. They're blown away. It's really fascinating. It's interesting. These are good people. Then we go out to the west side of Chicago, which is the poorest part of the black community of Chicago, and we spend the rest of the afternoon out on the west side with a woman who scrapes together in her own community the resources to feed some 300 mostly black, totally impoverished senior citizens every day. And they sit there and they talk to these seniors, our kids do, talk to these senior citizens for the rest of the afternoon, and to the woman who runs this place called Operation Brotherhood out on the west side. Talk to them about their realities, sort of get their life story, what's happened to their kids, what life is like on the streets for their kids, how many of them are in jail, how many of them are on crack, what the relationships are with the occupying army called the Chicago Police Department on the west side, what their relationships with their slum landlords are like, how life comes down on them on the west side of Chicago. And then that evening when we get them back to their apartments and talk about the bay that they've just had, we say, okay, we've got about 4 months together to figure out how it is that both of these realities that you experience today fit into the same city, right? That's our task. If we can figure out some way together in which these realities are a part of the same reality and part of an expression of the same kind of community, some ways in which all of the causal arrows can get drawn and all of the relationships can get understood, we will have succeeded. Well, those kinds of experiences repeated over a few weeks and months begin to get people into a different mindset about policy. They begin to get very suspicious about top-down policy, about policy determined by technocrats, about policy that takes efficiency and cost-effectiveness as a sort of central values about what it is you do to make life better, whether in housing or in food policy or in development or in job training or whatever else. They begin to think about policy much more in process ways. They begin to appreciate the sort of messiness of the democratic process, and they begin to ask more questions about who's at the table thinking about this policy rather than what is the policy outcome, knowing that who's at the table will determine a lot of the policy outcome. So process becomes very important to them. They become very sensitive to the way in which policy makers of the traditional kind identify problems usually as being the people at whom the policies are directed, rather than the systems which enable the housing and the food and the streets and the crime and everything else to happen. And finally, they get, marvelously sensitive in creative ways to the fact that most of the people who are not involved in making policies have incredible unused capacities, that they are not half-empty glasses, but they are at least half-full glasses with lots and lots of things to contribute to the greater good, and certainly to their own greater good, which are being squelched in all ways. Our students begin to see the poor as having virtually unlimited and untapped potential and capacities. And that, it seems to me, is an immensely liberating insight if you want to rethink policy. It's actually one of the things that there's a sort of part of Reagan that points to, but not with a whole lot of follow-up, at least in cities.
Let's say just a couple more words, and I think we need to open it up to you. Jody's last point, in which, and I think I would echo that in terms of the participants in our kinds of experiences, begin to see the poor as really vital actors in the whole shaping of policy and with a tremendous resource. We really, there are two ways in which we have experience with policymakers, and our people do, I think, that are very telling about the nature of shaping foreign policy. One has to do with when we have a group of policymakers, especially any at a congressional level or some high-level delegation, the difficulty in first of all, the recognition of how little these people understand about the countries where they're going or the issues, the realities that they're dealing with when they're making foreign policy decisions. In many cases, we've had situations where congressmen are much more interested in who their picture is taken with than they are in really listening to the voices of the people who are speaking, and particularly the voices of the grassroots. You know, one of our principles is that we always, any tour that we do, that people do not just listen to the movers and shakers in a country, but listen to people at the grassroots. Those are the first people that policymakers want to scratch from a schedule, because they don't see them as legitimate actors. And that coupled with the problem that most of them want to take 3 days to see four countries and try to understand the reality. So it's a very difficult problem we're dealing with here in terms of trying to really help policymakers understand the realities. And the other problem, or the other way we see the problem, of course, is when people come back from this kind of experience and attempt to approach their congressman or their policymaker on this issue, again, seeing very clearly how low on the list of priorities a particular foreign policy issue often is for a congressman, and again, the extent to which he or she has very little understanding of the issues at work. And, you know, one of the things that people often say is that, well, people who come back from or participate in these kind of experiences shouldn't come back thinking they're experts. And that's absolutely true. But on the other hand, one of the things I always say to people is, but you are more expert than most of the people who are making national policy on this issue. And I think it's a very important thing to keep in mind. And it's a very difficult thing, but it also suggests, I think, the importance that when we have policy being made in this kind of a vacuum, how important it is for citizens to be informed on foreign policy issues, to put the kind of pressure on that is needed, because somehow the awareness has to come from somewhere. Maybe we should.
Let's open it up. Should we open it up?
Yeah.
Let's open it up. We were going to tell a couple of stories about what happens to people, but we don't have to tell stories about that. You keep in touch with your folks, right?
Uh-huh.
We've got 400 or 500 around Chicago who've done the urban studies thing, and that's a nice network.
Actually, just to show what happens here, we have at least 3 staff people in our program that are graduates of Jody's program. So to see that kind of the kind of things that people get involved with after they've had this kind of experience is really, that's part of, I think, what makes us both stay with it for 20 years.
Boy, yeah. It's frightening. It's just frightening.
Yeah. Comments or questions from you all?
I have one. I know in trying to form community inquiries last year, elementary children, everybody thought the idea was really great, but the question I got asked most often and didn't know how to answer was, you know, how do you hold your students accountable? How does a teacher stay accountable and for learning? And how do you assess learning that goes on? And it was really hard, you know, you sort of have to hope for the best or decide that it doesn't matter. Or I was just wondering how you did it on a university level.
Yeah, I don't know how you do it, how you would do it on an elementary level.
How do you do it on college?
Well, I think that it's clear that when you're dealing with seminar-sized groupings mostly, you know, and one faculty person for a dozen or 15 in a seminar, something like that, that the relationships are so tight, really, so quickly, and it is such a mutual endeavor that there's a kind of group discipline that sets in, and it's very hard for a student to slack off. I mean, the problem is getting them to slow down once in a while and not try to pack everything in. The problem is telling them it's okay, you know, not to know everything and not to do everything that comes along, and not to have, it's really, we very seldom, I think, have the problem of somebody just punting. We're also in a situation where we can redefine what it is to succeed in an academic setting, right? We try to take very seriously what a student brings to us. So You know, for instance, in interaction with the city, white students interact very differently from black students with what's going on in a major American city. And they both interact differently from Hispanic students. Different ages interact differently. But there's a, you know, at the university level anyway, you don't necessarily have to quantify all that all the time. You know, there are papers, but there's also conversation that goes on every day. You sort of know.
I really echo that. I've been amazed in my own experience in this, the extent to which students, number one, get excited about learning in ways that I never experienced when I was teaching in the traditional classroom. I mean, go back to regular classroom now, just deadly for me. And this whole idea of almost wanting to do more than they can do. And there is, I think, in that kind of a setting also the possibility of sort of developing evaluation procedures that are in which students have responsibility for each other. I mean, the community becomes the evaluator. Now the problem comes, you know, and in our case it is as well, is we're still operating in the context of an institution that doesn't buy that, that operates on another system, right? And so in the end, somehow we have to feed back to that institution or the institution that these students are coming from a grade, even if it's a pass-fail. And in most cases, and here where you see the inconsistencies in the students, in the end the students say, well, maybe I really do want an A or a B rather than a pass-fail. You know, so it is a really difficult question. When you were talking the other night about this community of learning in elementary schools, I think that's, the concept to me is wonderful. I would love to see how you're able to do it. But the problem often is that system out there that is demanding something that doesn't fit, right? And can there be some way in which they're accountable to each other? But will the institution accept that?
Sometimes we find ourselves sort of entering into a conspiracy with the students, right?
Right.
They're saying, look, we really do have to hustle these colleges for these grades, right?
Yeah. We know what we're doing, and you know what you're doing, but...
How do we do it in a way that it doesn't get in the way of the learning?
It's one of the things that can be redefined.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right.
When you compare our higher education system with say a country like Japan or some of the European countries, when you're talking about liberating education, how does the American universities fit in as liberated compared to, say, something like Japan, which I understand is quite highly structured and very difficult for students to get into. But once in, they're in. But to strive to get in is very difficult for the Japanese to get into a university.
Yeah, you know, the Japanese, I think, we've gone through a 5-year period in the United States of sort of being fascinated by and almost worshipful of a variety of Japanese techniques. My brother works for the Japanese government, and I hear more and more of his government friends worried about the Japanese education system because of the stifling of creativity. It's awfully good at some sort of straight line, technically oriented, scientifically quantifiable stuff. But the kind of edge of discipline stuff that I was talking about, I think they're really worried about at this point, all the way through.
I would agree with that. And I think particularly if what we're talking about here is education that doesn't sort of program people into their niche in society. And I think that's part of what people in Japan might be worried about. And I think it's a problem throughout most Western education, is that tendency. I mean, you know, it's very interesting because there's a theory of liberal arts in which I think liberal arts in theory is almost everything we're talking about here.
Absolutely. If you read some of the original Greeks on this stuff,
that's right.
They could be sitting here.
And yet the reality of it is so contrary to, I mean, I think of Augsburg College's motto is through truth to freedom. We've taken that motto and used it, twisted it for all it's worth. Nobody else at the college has, you know. If they took seriously what that motto was, I mean, it's powerful.
Well, how many engineering students do you come into this? Mostly political science, what you said. But
it's a problem.
But,
I don't know how about you.
We've got a smattering of science students, and we're really grateful for even a smattering. They bring an interesting perspective.
Well, it's interesting. My daughter is a medical doctor. She finished her residency, and one of the things she wanted to do was to spend some time she wanted to go either to Mexico or Latin America. And I don't know how many organizations she wrote letters to, but the only one she got that was interested was in Africa, and she didn't want to go to Africa. She wanted Latin America, because she knew a little Spanish, but there was no opportunity. But I would think that would be needed there.
One of the things we found in terms of educational programs is there are hundreds of international study programs. We find there are very few that have the kind of approach that we're taking, which it's really that sort of critical analysis. You know, you go to learn about this or that, you know, it's arts in Europe or this, that, and the other thing. But to really kind of go abroad, to really reflect back on our own society and who we are as North Americans or North American Christians, you don't find much of that kind of program anywhere. Over here, there.
You know, I was wondering why don't things change? You know, why do they kind of keep perpetuating themselves? The details are a little different. You know, is there a human condition that we have to encounter as to why it doesn't happen? And I'm thinking about part of the men's group, and we were looking at sex, power, and money. And you know, with money, you got to encounter the human condition of greed. With sex, it's lust. With power, somebody suggests it's selfishness. You know, we're not willing to share the resources. We're not willing to share the power. You know, and I wonder if that's it sounds more reasonable all the time as I listen to different issues. You know, why don't we change things? Because we're too selfish. You know, it's our ego versus God's will type of thing.
Okay. Joel, I was wondering about your program and the impact of your program on those people in the countries. And you alluded a little bit to being afraid of their, their safety. And also, I was wondering especially about a country such as Guatemala, where it's obviously a repressive government, and what they're learning there is going to be somewhat suspect by the government.
That's a very important problem, and one we're always watching for, hopefully successfully most of the time, but perhaps not always. I think, first of all, the reason people will speak to us who are taking risks is because they believe it might have an impact, and it might help to change, which puts the responsibility back on us or the people who are participating. We're always obviously take whatever security precautions we can, and as much as possible try to take the lead of the people in the region to saying who can and who will speak. Never will talk to groups, for example. Guatemala is a very good example right now where it's become very, very repressive. And there are some people we simply are not able to talk to because it would put them at too much risk. We're always walking a very fine line with repressive governments, but part of that too is that whenever we're trying to also meet with people within those governments, so at least they can't say, well, you know, you're just listening to those voices. And so that's always held in very delicate balance, but it is also one of the reasons, again, why we put people in the region who are there on a day-to-day basis, can read these things, can be constantly in contact with people, to know who it's safe to meet with. The other issue, frankly, is not just a question of security, but is using and abusing people who have other work to do. And you know, when we have 40 groups a year to Latin America, you know, if we had somebody speaking to all of those groups, they wouldn't have time to do any more work, right? So it's really kind of assessing, making sure we're not overusing people and that we're being as unintrusive as possible, But also, if at any one point, one time, people in a country said, this is not helpful to us anymore to have groups coming here, we would stop it. I mean, it is really, in a very real sense, always at the invitation of people that were there.
Maybe one more in the formal session, and then we probably need to break, at least formally. Happy to continue informally.
You know, your comments about talking to the mass of people is not unlike what American industry is being faced with in adopting some of those Japanese techniques, where they ask the worker, how do we improve production? How do we improve the process? And that's how the Japanese achieved the eminence that they have achieved in the last few years, is they went to the people and asked them. And it really gets pretty powerful when you see what happens even in American factory, when they ask somebody, how do we improve that process? How do we?
Certainly nobody closer to the work than the people who are doing it.
That's right. They know what's going on. And if you ask them, they'll tell you. But if you don't ask them, the overwhelming emphasis has been, we know better what's better for you than you do.
They've got very powerful effectiveness teams. We call them ET at TI, and it's directly with the individual worker. They take over and are doing great work.
You know, this attitude that you mentioned, Phil, is really an important one. I mean, we see in academia professors saying, we know best what's best for students. I mean, how many students are involved in developing core curricula? Not nearly as many as ought to be, right? We see it in our whole area in working with relations and State Department. State Department is saying, we know best what, you shouldn't be here messing around trying to understand this stuff. We know best what the foreign policy ought to be. I think that is, in many respects, the kind of attitude we're fighting here and have to fight against.
It's important to know, I think, that the hottest book in terms of higher education writing these days is a book that basically attacks students. Right. That's guy at the University of Chicago.
Really? His name. I don't know. I don't know this book.
Closing of the American Mind. Right? Oh, yes. It's basically a diatribe about how dumb students are these days. Real helpful.
Talk about a paradox. Closing of the mind.
We need to close this session formally anyway, but we'd be happy to continue to chat. Consider it closed formally.
Yeah.
Thank you.